On this edition of Jazz Profiles, we'll celebrate the life and career of trumpeter Nat Adderley. He passed away in the year 2000, just a few months after this show was produced.
We got a thing that my brother has just recently got together that's based on a kind of Latin rhythm known as the bossa nova. But it's not really a bossa nova, but we think that you will dig this.
Everything that I ever heard that he wrote was easy to remember. He had a gift for melody.
Nat is known as a consummate player. He's known as a fine writer of funky material. And you also have to say that Nat is known for having spent all those years as the younger brother of a man who not only was a big success, but was a very flamboyant personality.
He didn't get the recognition, in my estimation, of his ability as a player because he was just a sideman in the Cannonball Adderley Quintet. But he could play, you know, he was a hell of a player. And together, they really had a great combination.
They was brothers to the core.
Nat Adderley was a remarkable trumpet player, but he spent most of his career in the shadow of his older brother, Julian Cannonball Adderley. In fact, his nom de guerre, the name he sometimes used on recordings, was just that, Little Brother. But unlike so many other famous jazz siblings who couldn't get along professionally, Nat and Julian were fast friends to the end. Nat looked after his older brother for many years, running the band business and writing many of their hits. And when Cannonball died, Nat carried on, not only with the band, but also with the family tradition of educating the next generation. I'm Nancy Wilson, and on this edition of Jazz Profiles, a remarkable tale of brotherly love, the story of Nat Adderley. It was 1962, and the Cannonball Adderley Quintet was at its peak. While alto saxophonist Cannonball Adderley remained the dynamic frontman, one of Nat's roles was to provide songs that folks could remember and go home singing. Perhaps the most popular was one called Work Song. Song was something Nat had written years before and then forgotten, only to be reminded by his mother.
Yeah, I remember my mother brought it. I had done it already and sketched it out for Mama. Mama only listened to what she claimed had character. she said, "That's a good song, say. That's the kind of song that people will remember." And she was right. People do remember it.
Mama was somebody that they listened to because Mama knew what it was all about.
Producer Orrin Keepnews.
Sugar, as she was known, was a tremendous person. I think one of the things that made me have an increased appreciation of Nat and Cannonball was getting to know their parents a little bit. If these are great people, those sons, one awfully big reason for it was they had wonderful parents.
This family feeling extended to the band as a whole. When you were part of the Adderley Quintet, you were part of something larger. Drummer Lewis Hayes.
The band was like a family. Everyone really got along together very well. That was one of the main opponents to the band that made it such a great organization, that everybody was very in tune with each other, on stage and off stage.
The band's manager, John Levy.
These guys loved each other. I mean, they got along just beautifully. I never heard a crossword between them during the years that I was with them.
Drummer Roy McCurdy.
Even their movements on the bandstand, when they snapped their fingers and moved their bodies, it was always the same. You know, I saw this from the back. And it was always in sync with them.
In the early 60s, Nat, in addition to being his brother's playing partner, also became his brother's keeper. That is, he became the tour manager. John Levy recalls.
He was really also the straw boss, as we used to call it. He took care of all the business. I did all the business with him, as far as money and travel and all the other arrangements for the band was done with Nat. Nat was the business person with that quintet.
I'm Nancy Wilson, and it's NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Nat Adderley. Nat Adderley was born in Tampa, Florida, November 25th, 1931. Both of his parents were professional people. His mother, known as Sugar, was a school teacher, and his father, Julian Sr., well, his father was a trumpet player traveling with a territory band until he got the word that he was needed back home. Nat Adderley explains.
When I was a little boy, he took a job with the Nighthawks, and they were halfway somewhere in Tennessee, I think he said, when I got in some paint crawling around the house, and he came off the road, and that's when he stopped playing.
Soon after, the family moved from Tampa to Tallahassee, because Tallahassee was the home of Florida A&M University. Both Sugar and Julian Sr. planned to become teachers, and they wanted to raise their two young sons, Julian the older by 3 years, and Nat, in an academic environment. It was a loving family in a strong, supportive community. Both boys were excellent students, and early on, they became interested in music. Their father not only encouraged their interest, but bought young Julian a $12 Sears and Roebuck trumpet. And he gave Julian his first trumpet lessons. Soon, Julian and Nat had formed a band.
He had the trumpet, and we had a little band in Tallahassee in school, the Royal Swingsters. And we could play all the little songs. I was a singer with the band, boy soprano. Cannonball played trumpet and was like the leader of the neighborhood band.
By the time the boys got to high school, Julian had switched to the alto saxophone. To do this, he first had to teach his younger brother, Nat, to play the trumpet so that their father would not feel the $12 had been wasted on the horn.
Julian stopped playing trumpet because he was smart enough kid to understand that there were some basic problems he had that he wouldn't have with other instruments. He wanted to play saxophone, and he bought the saxophone and gave me the trumpet and started teaching me to play trumpet, so that by the time, 2 or 3 months later, when Pop heard us play, one of his kids was playing the horn he bought.
And so, by 1940, with Nat on that Sears trumpet and Julian playing on the alto saxophone, the Adderley duo was fixed. That same year, all their friends had started calling young Julian by a new name, Cannonball. Nat explains how this evolved.
He had a prodigious appetite, so they wanted to call him a cannibal. And that eventually worked out to be Cannonball, because some people that didn't know perhaps what a cannibal was knew in the community what Cannonball was. And it stuck, a high school nickname that stuck.
Both Nat and Cannonball were academically gifted and graduated from high school by their 15th birthdays. After graduation, each enrolled at Florida A&M while still keeping their band alive. They also joined the school's marching band. Soon, music was taking up most of their time, and Cannonball, or just simply Ball, as he was sometimes called, was clearly becoming one of the local leaders. In the mid-40s, the brothers heard a new music from New York City called bebop. Both boys were enthralled by it, and immediately started copying the sounds of saxophonist Charlie Parker and trumpet player Dizzy Gillespie, the leaders of this new movement. On weekends, the brothers would travel to other parts of Florida with the university's marching band. Often, they got to meet other like-minded young men, particularly when the band traveled to Tampa. Trombonist Buster Cooper, who met the Adderley brothers during the mid-1940s, remembers.
We started jamming around Tampa, Florida, because that was the place then. Tampa, Florida was the kind of melting pot for all like the jazz guys from around Florida, you know, because it was like two army bases there. And it was like a lot of musicians was there, you know, like Walter Bishops and guys like that. So that's where everybody used to jam all night long and everything, you know.
Being the oldest, Cannonball was the first to graduate from the university with a degree in music education. He took a job teaching music at a high school in Fort Lauderdale. Nat wanted to follow in his brother's footsteps, but at the insistence of his mother, Sugar, he majored in pre-law. At an educational conference in 1980, Nat's mother explained why.
Nat was just as musical and musically inclined as Cannon, but I said, one musician in the family is enough. Nathaniel was an intelligent youngster, and I thought that law would be a good field because he liked to argue.
Even though he was separated from his older brother by many miles and was officially preparing for a different career, Nat took every opportunity to keep their musical collaboration alive. When the Korean War arrived, Cannonball enlisted in the Army. He wrote to his younger brother saying it would be better for Nat to enlist rather than be drafted. And so, in 1951, along with some of his musical classmates, Nat Adderley joined up. When he left the Army, he headed back to Florida A&M to continue his academic preparations. But it was not to happen. Sugar Adderley.
And I got a call one Sunday morning from this saying, Mama, I'm not going to law school. I am going to Europe with Lionel Hampton. I said, you've got to be out of your mind. Have you talked this over with your father? He said, yeah, I called him first. I said, well, what did he say? He said, call your mother. He said, we want what is best for you, but if this is what you want to do, then we'll have to step aside.
Nat had gotten a phone call from his old friend, Buster Cooper, who was with the Lionel Hampton Band in Chicago. Buster remembers.
So Hamp needed a trumpet player, you know, because one trumpet player was leaving, you know. And so I said, Hamp, I have just the right trumpet player for you, you know. So he said, well, where's that? So I said, well, his name is Nat Alley, and he lives in Tallahassee, Florida. Well, he said, Tallahassee? So I said, yeah, you know, Tallahassee. You know. So I got on the phone, and I called Nat that night, and Nat came like the next day.
Nat flew to Chicago, passed the audition with flying colors, and took off for Europe with the Lionel Hampton Band.
That was a wonderful experience. There were some of the best musicians that I had heard up to that point of playing with Lionel Hampton's band. Lionel Hampton had a great band, and he himself was a wonderful player. So it gave us the opportunity to learn as we grew. There was a lot of learning going on.
July 1955. Nat was back home in Tallahassee following a successful tour with Lionel Hampton. He often went to Fort Lauderdale to see his older brother Cannonball and to play gigs with him there. Then, one weekend, on a whim, the brothers decided to drive to New York City and visit their friend Buster Cooper.
I had dinner over to my house with Lou Donaldson and Sam Jones, and all of them came by. And after they ate the walls of my house down. So Ball asked me, was there any place, you know, to go play? So I say, Club Bohemia, you know.
The Cafe Bohemia was a club in Greenwich Village where many of New York's finest musicians gathered on a regular basis. Musicians like bassist Oscar Pettiford, drummer Kenny Clark, pianist Horace Silver, and saxophonist Jerome Richardson and Charlie Rouse.
When we went there that night, it just happened that Jerome Richardson was playing tenor, and he had a record date that night, so he was a little late. We came in early, we staying all night, and while we were there, Charlie Rouse came in, and Rouse walked up to the bandstand. They called him and said, hey man, you want to sit in with us until Jerome gets here? He's doing record day. And Charlie said, I don't have a horn. And he said, there's a guy over there with a saxophone. Cannonball had his saxophone. Because he had his horn and I had my horn, because they told us, you parked a car in New York, don't you leave that horn in there. You're going to come back and the horn's going to be gone. But when Charlie Rouse came over to the table and said, hello, listen, I'm Charlie. And he looked at Cannonball and he remembered they had been on a jam session in Florida. And instead of asking them to use the horn, Charlie Rouse said, listen, you want to play with them? And Cannon said, my God, yes. That's Oscar Pettiford, Kenny Clark, and Horace Silver. Rouse said, wait a minute. He went back and told him, say, he don't want to let me use his horn. He wants to play. But Rouse knew what he was doing. He knew that they were going to say, this is what Oscar Pettiford said. So send his behind on up here. He said, he got a lot of nerve, you know.
Cannonball did sit in that night. And as they say, the rest is history.
Oscar Pettiford called a fast tune to try to intimidate the unknown saxophonist from out of town. It turned out the other way.
Cannon could play fast as anybody. And when he got to the first break, Cannon started to play. Came in with that break. And Kenny Clark looked up from the drums and said, oh my God. So I think they played another song after that. And then Oscar said, well, who's the trumpet player? And Cannon said, that's my little brother. And Oscar said, can he play? So Cannon said, a little bit. So Cannon called me and I went up and played.
That night, after Nat and Cannonball sat in with Oscar Pettiford's band, the brothers knew that everything had changed for them. But they couldn't possibly know how quickly it would happen.
We left there that night, and Kenny Clark told us, "Hey, listen, you want to make a record date?" Said, yeah, he said, "I got a record date coming up next week, and y'all come and make it." And told us, gave us all the information, Savoy Records. So all that went down, and we went home in Cannonball laughing all the way. Said, "We done played with Oscar Pettiford and Kenny Clark and Art Silver." Nobody would have believed that. First night in New York.
Two nights later, the boys decided to drop back in at the Cafe Bohemia to see what was happening. It turned out what was happening was them. The legendary alto saxophonist Charles Yardbird Parker had died the previous March, and jazz musicians and fans alike were mourning the loss of this great leader. After Cannonball's performance two nights earlier, the word had spread throughout New York that the new bird had arrived. The Cafe Bohemia club owner saw the brothers as they pulled their car up to the curb.
He ran around the car and said, "Hey, where you been?" And he said, "Listen, come on in, you're hired. Now, we seriously about to go crazy. Hired to play with Oscar Pettiford and Kenny Clark? Yes. And now we got a job, and with these bad, great players." So Cannonball said, "We're in the middle of the street with the car running." He said, "Don't worry about the car. I'll park the car." This guy come around to get out, get your horn going in. So we did, and it turned out that people heard that the one they called the new bird had wandered into this club in the village. The club is packed, lines outside the club. It was amazing. So we ended up playing that the rest of the night, and the man paying us, and we got a job. And next week, we're going to record with Kenny Clark. We made an album, Bohemia After Dark.
Dark, recorded in July 1955, featuring Horace Silver, Kenny Clark, and the Adderley Brothers. Within weeks, Cannonball and Nat were both signed to Savoy Records and recording under their own names, but their hit songs were yet to come, largely due to the writing of Nat Adderley. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to a tribute to Nat Adderley on Jazz Profiles from NPR National Public Radio. By the mid-50s, Cannonball and Nat Adderley had firmly established themselves in New York City and were recording with some of the greatest legends of the day. But they also had plans to start their own band and had begun writing original material. Trumpeter Miles Davis, who had been at the Cafe Bohemia that first night, was so impressed with Cannonball's playing that he had called manager John Levy and urged him to handle the saxophonist's career. Levy agreed and helped organize the first Cannonball Adderley Quintet featuring Nat Adderley. But it was not the great success everyone had hoped for. Times were hard, and touring was no easy thing. John Levy.
The cost of traveling had gone up, and musicians were, when they hit the road, they were looking for, you know, if you wanted to keep a group together, you had to pay them a decent salary. And Cannon believed in really taking care of his musicians very well, so we found that the kind of money we could get for the quintet as a whole just didn't make it.
As Levy suggests, Cannonball wasn't very good with handling the money. Somehow, whatever amount came in, more went out. Producer Orrin Keep News sums up the situation.
I do remember Cannonball telling me that the best weeks that they had with that band were the ones when they weren't working, because at least they broke even.
By 1957, the first Cannonball Adderley Quintet had broken up, primarily because of financial problems. Cannonball himself left to become part of Miles Davis's classic sextet. And Nat first joined trombonist J.J. Johnson, and then became a member of the Woody Herman Band. But both he and Cannonball still had their dream of having a quintet of their own. In 1959, with his name and reputation soaring, Cannonball Adderley left the Miles Davis Band to reform the group with his brother, Nat. This time, they signed with a young record company, Riverside Records, that was interested in the band, not just Cannonball. The chemistry of the band was magic. Their first release for Riverside, recorded live at the Jazz Workshop in San Francisco, propelled them into the jazz stratosphere. Producer Orrin Keep News of Riverside Records remembers how it came about.
I made this wonderful sweeping promise that when you get a band together, as soon as you feel you're ready to record, you let me know, and I will come there and record you. I guess I was expecting a phone call from Philadelphia or something, but I got a phone call from San Francisco. Was terrific, the audience was incredibly responsive, and the material was quite wonderful. And that was their first hit. It really, you know, was a major success, the Cannonball Adderley Quintet in San Francisco, which said, as all of Cannonball's quintet albums said, featuring Nat Adderley. Ha ha ha!
Cannonball Adderley Quintet, recorded live in 1959 at the Jazz Workshop in San Francisco, their first album for Riverside Records. Seemingly overnight, the Cannonball Adderley Quintet became one of the leading forces in jazz.
What we accomplished with that record was the birth of what came to be redundantly and repetitiously known as soul jazz, and also it pretty much was the birth of contemporary live recording. And that was such a phenomenal success that not only did I do a lot of such recordings afterwards, but I think that virtually all jazz producers felt it was a good thing to do.
The quintet loved to swing and have a good time. And being brothers, they weren't afraid to let their hair down in public and share that family feeling. Drummer Lewis Hayes, who played with the quintet.
The band was very spontaneous. We didn't really rehearse that much. Basically, we just put it together on stage. Everyone just was more or less just playing, and it just came out a winner like that, first time.
Nat Adderley.
We couldn't believe it, but we were very popular. The young boys from Florida, we came at a time when we could get appreciated for what we could do.
Of Cannonball and Nat was magic, both musically and professionally. Cannonball was the charismatic frontman, while Nat wrote a lot of the hits that kept the books in order. Throughout the 60s, the success of the band was phenomenal. And while bassist Sam Jones and drummer Lewis Hayes stayed with the group throughout the first half of the 60s, the piano chair was occupied by a string of gifted players that helped put the group on the map. Perhaps none was more important than pianist Joe Zawinul, who delivered a song that sent the band onto the pop charts. Drummer Roy McCurdy, who had replaced Lewis Hayes, remembers the electricity the first time the group played the composition in public.
I think the first place we actually played it was Chicago in a club that was called The Club. And when we played it, the crowd, they just went crazy because they had this little pause in it. And after that pause, and we started playing again, the crowd would just start screaming and yelling. That's when we finally decided that, yeah, this is it. This is going to be a hit tune.
It sold over 1 million copies, an enormous hit in the jazz world. Mercy, 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 recorded in 1966 by the Cannonball Adderley Sextet. As the band's popularity soared, Cannonball and Nat used their newfound influence to further the careers of musicians they felt deserved wider recognition. Guitarist Wes Montgomery, pianist Ellis Marcellus, trumpeter Chuck Mangione, and a singer from Columbus, Ohio, named Nancy Wilson. That's right. When I arrived in New York the first time, I met Cannonball and Nat on 52nd Street. The following year, I saw Cannon when he was with Miles at the 502 Club in Columbus. And of course, when I made the decision that I was ready to do what I do, going to New York a few months later, Cannon and Nat were the first people I called when I got there. It was just the beginning of a long and beautiful friendship. Touring with the Adderley Brothers definitely made me feel that I, too, had joined a close and extended musical family.
Never, never will I marry. Never, never will I wed. Born to wander solitary, wide my world, narrow my bed. Never, never, never will I marry.
Adderley on trumpet, Cannonball Adderley on alto saxophone, and yours truly, Nancy Wilson, singing Never Will I Marry. Throughout the late 60s, even as jazz gave way to rock and roll, the Cannonball Adderley Sextet rode a wave of popularity. And when jazz bands finally did start appearing at rock venues like the Fillmore East, they discovered that it was possible to extend their audience without having to compromise their music. A great fear among jazz players of the day.
We managed to get across by being honest. We didn't claim that we could play like the Jefferson Airplane or even Miles Davis at the time. We didn't claim to be anything other than what we were. And we kept doing that. And people found that they liked what we were, which was good enough.
I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to a tribute to Nat Adderley on NPR's Jazz Profiles. Since the early 60s, the Cannonball Adderley Quintet, featuring Nat Adderley, had been one of the top attractions in jazz. Suddenly, all that would end. On July 13, 1975, while completing a tour of the Midwest, Cannonball Adderley suffered a major stroke. Drummer Roy McCurdy, who was traveling with him at the time, remembered how it happened, one unforgettable morning, in a hotel they had just checked into.
The next morning, Cannon called me and said, why don't we have some breakfast? And I said, well, I've already eaten, but I'll come down and have some coffee with you. So when we went downstairs, the restaurant had just closed, and he was talking to the waitress, trying to get her to open it up. He was kidding with her and everything. And while he was doing that, he looked over at me, and he kind of slapped his face, and his speech was gone. And he just, at that particular time, he had a stroke. And you know, that was it. Once he got to the hospital, he stayed in there for a couple of weeks, and then pneumonia got him, and that's how he passed away.
The death of Cannonball Adderley at age 46 was an enormous shock to the jazz community, and an even greater blow to his younger brother, Nat. Cannonball had always been Nat's best friend, his teacher, and a fellow witness to so much jazz history. And for virtually all of their professional careers, Nat had focused on supporting his older brother.
Now, the loss was real, and it was permanent. And the future opened up in front of Nat with a large question mark. At first, even though it was difficult, Nat resolved to keep the basic quintet together.
But I knew we had to keep playing. We had to keep performing, doing the best we could. And I thought that we had further to go.
Roy McCurdy.
Nat put a band together with basically the same people we had. Charles McPherson played with us for a while, and we did some things around country, went over to Europe and did some things, and played basically the same tunes that we played with the Cannonball Adderley Band. But it didn't last very long. It lasted for just a few months, and then it was over with.
Eventually, in 1989, Nat formed an all-new group, much in the tradition of the Cannonball Adderley Quintet, but this time featuring a young discovery of his own, saxophonist Vincent Herring. And in the process, Nat also discovered that he, too, had a talent for teaching, passing along his years of experience to a new generation. Vincent Herring.
Well, it's funny that most important lessons that I learned from Nat had more to do with developing my personality and maturing and my social behavior. But I learned a lot also about music as well in terms of interpretation and in terms of what music meant to him and what he was able to project it to people.
I'm convinced that reading music is as simple as learning fractions. I'm convinced of that.
Nat Adderley at an educational conference held in 1980.
Any child who understands fractions can understand music because basically the number system of reading music, other than recognizing the symbols, that's all it is. It's no great secret. But we try to make it sound mysterious to people because we want to be different. Just as lawyers who draw up contracts put whereases and therefores in order to throw you a curve to make it seem mysterious, when in fact, if they didn't put the whereas and therefores in, we wouldn't need lawyers, because we could read the contract ourselves. But they throw things in to confuse you, and it makes all that study seem important. So we make a big mysterious deal out of it. But it really wasn't difficult for me to learn to read music at all, because I understood mathematics. And I believe that any child that understands fractions can read music.
In the classroom at Florida Southern College, where Nat began teaching in the mid-90s, he discovered he had a gift for sharing the real inside knowledge of jazz with his students. He let them know, for example, that in jazz, there are no mistakes, only opportunities.
Hey, you know, you really do hear well. I know you hear well because you kept hitting some wrong notes and you'd slide into the right one.
That
much is important. That's very important. You know, to be able to hear, hey, that won't work. And that's what you did. And that's very good. That's very good. It starts getting interesting when you hit the wrong note. When you hit the wrong note and you hear what the right one is, that's how you start innovating. And that's what we're here for. Good.
And then, during the late 1990s, Nat began to suffer from crippling diabetes, the disease which had also weakened his brother years before. By 1999, Nat was forced to give up teaching as well as playing. And now, like that of his brother Cannonball, Nat's legacy exists in the music he leaves behind and in the many lives he's touched. Again, Vincent Herring.
Nat is very much a fatherly figure to me, both musically and socially, and made a huge difference in my life and still does, and one of the best friends anyone could ever have.
Orrin Keep News remembers how Nat passed along some hard-earned wisdom to another famous jazz sibling, saxophonist Branford Marcellus. Branford was also struggling with a more famous brother, trumpeter Wenton.
Nat told me, he said, I ran into Branford on a gig in Florida the other day, and I had a long talk with him, and I explained to him what it means to be the other brother, and I think I got him all straightened out. So Nat was and is, I guess, even though it's been many years since Cannon's left us, an expert on being the other brother.
Martin Luther King said, I want to be remembered for having led a committed life. But I'm no Martin Luther King, you know. But I do want to be remembered for having been committed to something. I think everybody ought to be committed to something. I don't want to play bad music because I don't want to be remembered for having played bad music. I think that most jazz people somewhere in their minds, the ones who don't, quote-unquote, sell out, won't do it because you really just want to be remembered for having been committed to something of value.
Nat Adderley is remembered as a man who brought great joy, fun, and good times to many people through his writing, playing, and teaching. And he stood by his brother through thick and thin, keeping his eye on the musical prize for over 50 years. In the words of his boyhood friend, Buster Cooper,
those students are lucky, believe me, you understand what I'm saying?
Our tribute to Nat Adderley was written and produced by Ben Sidran. Post-production engineers were Soraya Muhammad and Rima Snyder. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. Molly Murphy is our editor. Website coordinator, Patrick Breslin. Special thanks for additional research to Nat Adderley biographer, Jeff Clements, and to Gig Brown of the Jazz History and Research Program at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. Thanks also to Dan Marks at Savoy Records and to Carol Troyer Shank. Engineering assistance provided by Seal Muller at KQED in San Francisco, Bob Seymour at WUSF in Tampa, Doug Johnson at KPCC Pasadena, and Marsha Caldwell, Neil Rausch, Manoli Wetherell, and Leo Del Aguila of NPR. To email us or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund.
helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts.
That's called the Sticks, ladies and gentlemen, the Sticks. Thank you very much.
I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've been listening to a celebration of the life and career of Nat Adderley. He passed away in the year 2000, just a few months after this show was produced. Discover more great jazz at NPR Music, including our new series, Live at the Village Vanguard, live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.